Good evening, everybody. Welcome to Masterclass tonight, this Thursday, September 28th, 2023. We have a good team coming on tonight, good crew of presenters this evening. Should be a lot of fun. A lot of different topics going on tonight, which is going to be really interesting because there's a few of these I really want to know about that I didn't, and I'm glad that they chose them. So I'm sure all of them will be just as good. Let's go ahead and start off with the first one on the list. I did put the agenda in the chat for this and in Teams, both in the organization announcement and the masterclass Teams meeting chat, which if we start to get really busy, you might want to use the Teams meeting chat instead of the chat that's on the recording where we are right now, seeing each other's faces, only because that takes a lot of resources within Teams itself to even run these meetings. So I think that's the problems that we're having on Tuesday on AHOD meetings. So, all right, let's get started. We have, Raciel, are you ready? Get me out of here. Don't see him here. I wonder sometimes if they feel I'm going to present it because I'm not, unless they've recorded it.
Raciel sent a message saying he was going to be working late and if you could move him back.
Okay, we can do that. We will skip to the next person. As soon as I get there. Hi, Raciel. Are you able to present, or do you want me to just go ahead with the next person and then you'll be ready? Okay, let's go with Brian. Are you ready?
I am.
All righty.
All right, let me get my share on here. All right, can you guys see my screen?
I can.
All right, wonderful. All right, so tonight I am going to be discussing social engineering. I chose this topic because it is something that affects us all every day, multiple times a day. It also can lead to a lot of serious consequences. So without further ado, social engineering. So first topic is, what is social engineering? So it is a term used for a range of malicious activities that are accomplished through human interactions. It's a lot of playing with human emotions and exploiting human emotions to get us to do things that we should not do, or to fall for certain things that we shouldn't fall for. It uses psychological manipulation to trick users into making security mistakes or giving away sensitive information. Moving right along, I want to discuss some of the statistics over the recent year regarding social engineering. So in the broad world of cyber attacks, 98% involves social engineering on some level. It could include masquerading as a trusted contact to encourage an employee to click on a link and spread malware or ransomware, or an email pretending to be a banking institution to capture login credentials, or anything that's designed to exploit human in order to get into a target system or any type of landscape. On the data breach front, social engineering is a popular approach to gaining access to target systems. In some cases, it's easier to trick an employee into handing over sensitive information than it is to gain entry through brute force, saving a lot of time. As a result, between 70 and 90% of data breaches involve social engineering. The average organization is targeted by 700 plus annual attacks annually, so each year. Now, considering that there's about 260 work days, it means that organizations faced about 2.7 social engineering attacks per day. Social engineering attacks are costly. Even if they don't lead to intense data breaches, on average, companies lose $130,000 through money theft or destroyed data. In cases where social engineering does lead to a major data breach, the totals can reach hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars. Moving on. So social engineering is the process of attacking and taking advantage of human emotions. I'm going to discuss the four emotions that are preyed upon most. The first is fear. Malicious actors commonly use fear to manipulate victims because it is one of the most powerful human emotions. This is where you're being threatened with jail term for not paying the IRS, or they're telling you that you've got something major going on in your account, and if you don't respond quickly, you're going to lose access, or anything of that nature. The next emotion is greed. Now, as humans, we all have those moments where we experience this and where we do want something that we probably can't get on our own or something of that nature. And this is where they take advantage of this. This is a major one that actually happened to my aunt who was living in Florida. She fell for the 419 Nigerian scam, and they were convincing her to go to get green dot cards to basically send them money, because they were promising her fortunes if she did this. The next emotion is helpfulness. From a young age, most of us are taught to be helpful and obedient. That willingness to help others is used against us by social engineering. For instance, criminals seek out customer service agents because they are helpful in nature, and that helpful mindset makes them easy targets. The last emotion is curiosity. Curiosity is exploited when attackers promise something something of interest to deceive its victims. This is where you're getting the pop-ups for the free laptop if you complete the survey. Now let's talk about the life cycle. So the first step of the life cycle of a social engineering attack is the investigation phase. Now this is where they're going to look at your Facebook. If you have a LinkedIn profile, they're going to look at your LinkedIn profile. They're going to learn you. They're going to learn what makes you tick. They're going to learn what you do and how you do it. And then they're going to take advantage of that to accomplish what it is they're trying to accomplish. The second step is the hook. This is where they gain access by building the relationship. They're going to tell you a story. They're going to do something that makes you.
Company using AWS services that also is a strip.
Say that again. Hello? Okay.
I think it was a hot mic.
Okay. All right. So let's see. We were at the hook. So this is like, as an example, this is where in a phishing emails, an attacker engages the victim with a fake job promotion to a company, and they can accept it by going on to click a link. Research, I know you're looking for a job. I can see you going on job search sites. And now hook, hey, here's a job. Click this link. And let's get started. Step three is going to be the play. Now, this is where we are when you actually execute the attack. This is where when you click the link, this is where you spread the ransomware. This is where you provide the information that's sensitive and is going to get you put into some type of a negative consequence. And then step four is just the exit. This is where all communication is deleted. The person that you've been talking to disappears, and then you're left holding the bag. Now let's move on to some types of social engineering attacks. A lot of these you've heard of. There were a couple that I was not aware of previously, but very interesting. So first is the most common, which is phishing. This is the most common type of attack. Typically use spoofed emails or address links that aim to trick you into providing login credentials, credit card numbers, or any other type of personal information. Then there are variations to this, which are spear phishing, where there is a specific target of these phishing attacks. Then there's whaling, where we're specifically going after CEOs. CEOs are one of the most socially engineered job titles around the entire country. And then there is a social media term known as angler phishing. And this is what we commonly see on Facebook, where people impersonate others or major businesses to try to trick you into believing that you're talking to them. The next one is diversion theft. Now, diversion theft is basically where the social engineer goes after the delivery driver or courier and convinces them to hand the package off to a third party or another location, or as they call them, drops, which are essentially empty houses that no one lives at. They wait for the package to get dropped off, and then they pick it up. This is a major source of theft for a lot of businesses. In this instance, after they get your account details, they place an order using your credit card information, and then they have the shipping address, after it's confirmed to go to you, sent somewhere else. And this is an attack on many shipping companies. The next is baiting. Baiting is basically where they use an attack that lures the victim into providing some type of sensitive information by promising something of free. This is where your free iPad comes in. This is where you've won a free iPhone 15. This is where you've won anything, that all you have to do the survey and continue through that. The next that I'll talk about is the honey trap. This is basically a dater's trap type of scenario. Perpetrators pretends to be romantically or sexually interested in the victim and then lures you into an online relationship that eventually could have you reveal something that is confidential that will allow them to take advantage of you, or in most cases, to provide them sums of money. And then the next is pretexting, which is a fairly sophisticated type of attack in which a scammer creates a fabricated scenario. This is where the IRS auditor comes into effect with the taxes that you owe, or if you don't pay them, you could be facing jail time or some type of major penalty. And then the final is scareware. Scareware is basically a form of social engineering where the scammers basically insert malicious code into a web page, that when you visit, sends you a pop-up that tells you that your computer is infected and may shut down if you don't call this number, download this software, or do something that's going to, in fact, infect your computer even more. If you do click on that malware, you could possibly end up with ransomware or anything of that nature. So now that we've talked about the major types of social engineering, I want to talk about what to do to protect yourself, your loved ones, or if you are running a business, your company. The first is to train, to educate and to train. The best way to counteract these things is to know about them and to know how to react to them and to be able to spot things that don't look real. The second thing is, do not open emails and attachments from suspicious sources. If you don't know who the sender is in question, you don't need to answer an email. And even if you do know them, you have to be specific and cross-check and confirm things on there, because a lot of the times they just change certain characters in the address to make it look like it's going to the main site. And it even has gone a step further to where the link that you click on looks like exactly what you're expecting it to look like. This is a major one for corporate. The third is to use multi-factor authentication. This is something that I have set up on just about any account that I have nowadays. And I still have instances where I have to change passwords because I'm getting an alert that somebody's trying to log in. Multi-factor authentication means that you have to have a specific device in order to be able to access this specific site. And without having that on there, without that two-factor, it's just a matter of getting a password. Be wary of tempting offers. I mean, if it sounds too good to be true, then it more than likely is. And then the final is to keep antivirus and anti-malware software updated. Because as these things come out, those programs are updated. So they're aware of them in advance. So if you do run into a situation or go to a site that's inappropriate, this software will tell you and it will protect it. If you download a bad file, it'll automatically quarantine it and delete it for you. It's just a great tool to have to keep yourself protected. All right. That will do it for the presentation. Here are the references that I used in putting this together. I do thank you all for your time this evening. Any questions?
I did have one question. When you had that spamware, is there another name for it? Would that be considered a DDoS?
That's usually DDoS, I think. Isn't that where with DDoS, they send you so many requests that you can't handle it. And after it, it basically shuts your system down because you're sending so much at it that it can't even keep up. So that's a different type of attack, but that can happen by, clicking on a bad link. It can definitely give them access to be able to perform that type of an attack.
That makes more sense. Okay.
Great presentation.
Yes. Excellent. Excellent job.
I'm so glad you did that. Now I need to worry about the IRS, FBI, DOJ, KGB.
Of that is, man, it happened to me. And like I said, it happened the Nigerian scam happened to my aunt and it literally broke her. Broke her.
I wrote back to them, told them I wanted the job and had them send me the check and everything. I said, I went to the bank and they said it was fake. What do I do now? And they were like, no, we don't need you anymore.
I couldn't believe it. I really couldn't believe it, but it's still going on. And when I'm talking this happened back in maybe 2010 when it happened to her.
Yeah.
And it's still going on to this day. And it's like, absolutely, we haven't caught on yet.
I know. The word has not gone around.
There's a lot not computer savvy. And I think Brianna has a question.
Sure, go ahead.
Oh, it's just a statement. I'm so glad that you did your presentation on this because there are so many people that are just, especially like older people, like my grandparents, for example, and they get so much, like so many text messages with links and emails and calls and stuff. And I feel like there needs to be a better way to like somehow educate people, specifically the older population.
This is something that I see on a daily basis because I do tech support for T-Mobile. So I'm always getting calls about how do I stop these messages? And I have to tell them, you can't. The only thing you can do is to know about them. If it looks like it's not real, you just have to delete it and ignore it. Because we've tried everything we could. We've stopped the scam callers to a certain extent, but they just moved into SMS. So now it's a whole animal that we're having to deal with.
Yeah,
absolutely. And my grandparents say the same thing. Can't we stop it? I'm like, man, no. There really isn't a way. Just don't click on anything and ignore it and delete it. You know, it's just, it's sad. That's it.
It's a number you don't know, just right away say, take me off your list. Don't even say hello or anything. Take me off your list. Mm-hmm. That's it.
Yep.
Exactly.
Or go ahead and add them to the block list. That works too.
Yep. Sandra?
Yes, I wanted to add on that. And that I've constantly talked to my mom about it because she's elderly. And so she's finally gotten to the point where, no, she will not do that and not click on any of the links. And I'm like very grateful. But I'm all pleased about this, that last month I got to put on my security hat at work because I do internal help desk for an insurance company. And the best thing that happened was that an elderly insurance customer had received what she thought was an email from the company stating that she won a $100 gift card. First thing she did was she called her agent. And I was like, oh, I am so glad.
Oh, nice.
I am so glad. And so I was actually, yes. And I was, it was actually a staff member in the office. And so I was able to actually put on my security hat and show her how she can, you know, just the basic things of how she can find to make sure that, you know, where the email is coming from, you know, just do the start with the forwarding so you can look to see where the email is actually coming from, and then to mouse over the link. Not touch it.
And I mean,
but that she actually called her agent first. I was like, oh, I am so happy.
Kudos, you get an ice cream or a cookie. You know,
but
something
good to put on my security.
Doing the right thing. Absolutely. Right. Well, that was wonderful. Excellent job. Great presentation. And I might use that for my students at the time comes during that week. So, or that unit. Rick, did you have a statement or a question? No.
Yeah, I just, I did. Sorry. I was just going to say, Brian, you know, great information. And being in the banking industry for 13 years, technology itself and the vulnerabilities that have come across, especially on the consumer side, has just exponentially grown since 2020. We're now starting to see methods where they're utilizing falsified number dialers to basically mimic a customer service number from the institution these people bank at to act on behalf of it, having that they have that information, knowing like addresses and personal information already, thinking it's the bank calling them about fraud, causing them to give them information over the phone for them to do identity theft or anything else possibly. Alternatively, phishing options, thinking it's the bank emailing them, that it will then install apps or they call them and they have them download an app that makes an elderly person think that they're, say, iPad turned off, when in reality it's the app they're controlling that turns off the screen. They log into their online banking and access all their financial records at that point.
It's terrible.
Yeah, so great information.
I literally had that call yesterday. This lady called me. She could not. So since they were using a dialer, they couldn't send her a short code. They had pretended to be her bank's fraud department. And I'm like, ma'am, there's nothing coming through. There's nothing for you to worry about. You need to forget you even talk to those people.
Yeah. And the elderly and sadly, the ones that have financial struggles are sadly the ones that end up falling for it the most.
Yeah. Such a horrible time to do that, too. Well, there's never a good time to cheat somebody out of their money anyway, so.
No, never.
A lot to learn. All right. So, thank you for your presentation. Again, excellent job. Let's move on, give Raciel a little bit more time to get ready. And Brianna, are you ready?
Yeah, I am. Just one second. Can you guys hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay, sorry if you guys hear my dog, too, by the way.
Grandfathered in, we can't help that. Lawnmower people, I mean, lawn care, you know, children, those things we can't help.
Kids, that's another one. They just come barging in, everybody stay out, and then that's when everybody needs something.
No, mom's doing something, I gotta go in.
Yeah, they just don't quite get that. All right, anyway, can you guys see the screen okay?
Yes, we can.
Okay. Does it show the little square on your guys' end too, or is that just on my end?
Just your end.
Okay, got it. All right. Hi, I'm Brianna, and I'm going to be discussing defense in depth and a few other frameworks. So defense in depth is something that I'm aware most of you are familiar with. It implements several layers with the mindset that if one layer is breached, the others will fill in the holes to keep the network secure. It was it's designed with the CIA triad in mind to ensure that the network data is kept confidential, integrity is maintained, and that systems and data are accessible when it is needed. The defense in-depth model was developed by the NSA with a military mindset at the center. Sometimes it's referred to as the castle approach because the concept traces back to the era of castles and using moats, towers, drawbridges, and other various methods for security. The defense in depth is a very holistic strategy that gives organizations an adaptable approach to keep their network safe. It is also a resilient model that keeps the organization equipped to handle and recover from an attack. It is also an adaptable model due to its ability to adapt to evolving threats and technology. The professionals can modify the layers to address new cybersecurity threats without having to completely overhaul the security infrastructure. Furthermore, defense in depth is comprehensive because each layer can focus on numerous aspects of security, ensuring various attack vectors are covered. Now, with all models, there are challenges that arise. Implementing the defense in depth model is complex and resource intensive. The organization implementing defense in depth must ensure that they have skilled professionals to effectively manage and model the layers. It is also costly, so they must ensure that their desired security controls fit within the allocated budget. Another challenge is that security layers increase, there's also an increase in false positives. There is also the potential of vulnerabilities within each layer, making it crucial that the layers are continually monitored and assessed because an attacker could exploit a weakness in one layer to bypass others. As technology changes, so do the way that attackers design their attacks. And some techniques will allow them to bypass several security levels at one time. And because of the advancements in advancements, cybersecurity techniques must adapt. So let's explore the concept of proactive cybersecurity, which encompasses all the various techniques done prior to an attack taking place. Far too often, organizations do not properly prepare, and when an attack does take place, it's too late. The tactics of proactive cybersecurity include hiring professional penetration testers that will try to breach the network and report back to the organization the weaknesses that were found. The security team then should take that data and repair the weakness in the network to prevent malicious hackers from accessing the network. Another tactic is threat hunting, which utilizes security professional skills to search through a network and actively find threats. The use of proactive cybersecurity enables the team to be able to constantly be on the lookout for threats that lie on hosts or networks and quickly resolve any issues before they make it further into the network. Now, opposite of proactive cybersecurity is reactive cybersecurity, which is responding to an incident after it had already happened. Reactive cybersecurity tactics include incident response, which will outline the steps taken to contain, analyze, and mitigate the impact of the breach. Another tactic is forensics and investigation of the incident. This is where the professionals will conduct a forensic analysis to obtain as much information on the attack as possible. It is also important to minimize the damage with damage control tactics, which include isolating the affected systems, removing malware, and restoring the data. With technology constantly evolving, it takes a variety of security measures to ensure that a network is secure as possible. The addition of proactive methods adds an entirely new dynamic to the way that organization can protect the network. It is crucial to ensure that there are measures added in the event of a breach. In a perfect world, the idea is to prevent attacks entirely, but unfortunately, that is not as easy as it seems. Just as fast as cybersecurity professionals develop ways to secure a network, a malicious hacker is finding a way to exploit the network, which is why many organizations are implementing the Zero Trust framework. So a Zero Trust model assumes that every request is a breach. There's no trust with anyone or any device. Each request must be authenticated, authorized, and encrypted every time. This concept takes away the idea that everything behind a firewall is safe and adds an entirely new set of rules to keep a network secure. This model makes use of the principle of least privilege, which ensures that users only have access to what they need to do their job. Nothing more, nothing less. The use of zero trust ensures that users' device behavior, network traffic, and system activity will continuously be monitored, and any anomaly will be detected in real time, allowing for an immediate response. Implementing zero trust will improve security tremendously because it reduces the attack surface by requiring continuous authentication and authorization for access to resources. One of the largest issues security professionals have faced in recent times is the increase in remote work due to COVID. At the peak of COVID, when everyone was in lockdown, there were many organizations that had to continue working. So they introduced remote work. With the use of zero trust, the user's experience will be improved because it offers a seamless and user-friendly experience compared to models that rely on network-based access controls. With the increase of remote work came several security risks, which is why the use of the Zero Trust framework became so popular. There are many organizations adopting this model, including Microsoft. There are challenges to implementing the Zero Trust model, one being that it is complex to set up. It requires re-architecting network infrastructure and redesigning policies. The implementation of zero trust is resource heavy and requires a significant number of resources, including a financial investment, skilled professionals, and ongoing monitoring and management. It is also challenging because organizations invest large sums of money into traditional security tools and solutions that are not easily compatible with zero trust. So the transition can be time consuming and costly. The final point is that employees may be resistant to the change because it is drastically different than what they are used to. So it is important that they are properly educated on the reason for the change. Cybersecurity training is something that I'm extremely passionate about. I believe the vast majority of people do not understand the power of that technology carries. In an organization setting, it is important that employees understand their role in cybersecurity. As professionals, we have our specific role to fulfill, and quite frankly, it's a lot of responsibility that we all carry. But to aid in success, I believe that it takes the cooperation of the entire organization to keep a network safe. The human factor is where many data breaches originate. So designing a training to make the employees aware of how breaches can occur will aid in the prevention of attacks. Social engineering, like Brian discussed, is a technique that hackers can use to get as much information as they can find on the internet about a person. People tend to post everything on social media, and so it's important that employees are informed of that, and all work-related information should not be posted anywhere. With that said, it is important that cybersecurity training happens regularly with employees to keep it fresh in their minds so that they know what to look for and create a workforce that is team-oriented in the task of keeping a network safe. Overall, securing an organization's network can be done in a variety of ways. And as professionals, we must advise on which framework will be best suited for the organization and their needs. The Defense in Depth framework is popular and has worked for many organizations, but as remote work increases, so does the implementation of zero trust frameworks. I believe securing a network takes a variety of tools, and as I previously stated, educating an organization's workforce is crucial to the overall success of the security framework chosen. It is important that security professionals and the employees work together as a team to keep a network secure from malicious hackers. Here's all my references, and thank you guys for listening, and if there's any questions.
Great job. Nice work.
Thank you. Sorry for all the background noise. I just hear my children and my dog, and it's so, I swear, they just don't ever listen to me.
It's okay. I didn't hear anything, so.
Oh my gosh. I'm so glad, because I just hear my children, like, laughing hysterically. My dog's barking at probably a cat, and I just was like, oh my gosh, please don't hear this.
You're good. That was great. Does anybody have any questions for Brianna? All right, well, that was wonderful. A lot of good information. Let's go on to Wesley. Are you ready? Okay, Raciel, we'll get you after Wesley. If Wesley's here. Wesley's not here. Was I supposed to do this one? I think so. So, okay, tell you what, let me see if I can find something. Russell, you go ahead if you're ready. See anything.
Hi, everyone. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Cool. All right, let me see how I do this. Hopefully, I won't mess up. It's loading. Are you guys able to see my PowerPoint?
Yes.
Okay. All right. So my name is Raciel. I was born in Cuba, and I'm pursuing a bachelor's degree in information technology with software development as a concentration. And last week, one of my teammates, classmates, gave a presentation about cryptocurrencies, and I just wanted to expand a little bit on that because I found it very interesting. So let me go to my next slide. So before getting into today's agenda, I would like to highlight why it is important to us to have a basic understanding of blockchains and cryptocurrency technology as IT professionals and also as prospective users. Blockchain is a sophisticated database system that enables seamless sharing of information within a corporate network. Although blockchain technology's popularity started with the initial stages of cryptocurrencies like Bitcoins, it is becoming a mean for potential solutions in other industries, such as supply chain, retail, healthcare, and government. So what is cryptocurrency? Cryptocurrency is a form of digital or virtual currency that relies on cryptographic security, making it extremely difficult to counterfeit or engage in double spending. Most cryptocurrencies operate on decentralized network that utilize blockchain technology, which is a distributed ledger. So it's sort of like an accounting book, upheld by a diverse network of computers. A defining feature of cryptocurrencies is that they are generally not issued by any central authority, rendering them theoretically immune, or making it, in other words, making it immune to government interference or manipulation. So what does cryptocurrency signify to the modern financial landscape? Because cryptocurrencies function in decentralized networks, it gives people direct control over their financial assets. This openness to everyone has the potential to change the way money works and solidify the idea of transitioning from a traditional banking to crypto banking. With crypto banking, people might manage money and cryptocurrencies in one account. This connectivity made switching between cash and digital assets a straightforward thing. Individuals have the option to handle both traditional currency and cryptocurrencies within a single account, allowing for easy transition between physical and digital assets. This seamless integration ensures that transactions remain transparent, irreversible, and immune to tampering. This all happening while granting individuals with full ownership. Let me see my next slide. Now, how cryptocurrency works? That's a good question. As previously mentioned, a cryptocurrency works primarily with blockchain technology. To use cryptocurrency, a digital wallet is necessary. These digital wallets serve as a repository for private and public keys. The public keys function as a unique cryptocurrency address, while the private keys are utilized to endorse transactions, serving as evidence of ownership. Now, if you intend to transfer cryptocurrency to another individual, you must initiate a transaction. This transaction holds the recipient's public key, the specified amount for transfer, and a digital signature formed with your private key. This digital signature serves as verification of your ownership of the funds. Your transaction then is broadcasted to the cryptocurrency network. Nodes in the network verify the transaction validity by confirming that you indeed have the funds you're trying to send, and such digital signature is valid. This verification process is known as mining. Cryptocurrencies implement a consensus mechanism to establish agreements on the blockchain status. For instance, in Bitcoin, miners compete to solve intricate mathematical puzzles. The first miner to succeed in solving such problems earns the privilege to append a new block of transaction to the blockchain and is rewarded with newly generated cryptocurrency. Here there is a table with some of the well-known cryptocurrencies. Of course, Bitcoin is number one. And as maybe three days ago, it was worth $26,107. On the right side, on the very right column, there are some feature and use cases. And for instance, with Bitcoin, offers security, transparency, immutability, and pseudonymy. There is the Ether. The value is $1,576. And there's also Litecoin, which is not, I didn't put it here. It kind of came back to my mind later, but that one is very popular. Let's see. Now let's talk about some crypto risk and mitigation strategies. Reviewing the pros cryptocurrencies might offer, we can summarize that this new way of banking eliminates single point of failure, facilitates transferring funds among parties, which means it also cut off third parties' entities. Cryptocurrencies can be utilized to generate returns.
That's why I'm reading it now. Wonder what would happen on different types of GP.
You have a hot mic.
Okay. Lastly, remittances to overseas are streamlined. However, it is important to understand the risk associated with these virtual currencies. One of them is user risk. In contrast to conventional financial system, there is no option to undo or annul a cryptocurrency transaction once it has been executed. For user, another risk is the user risk mitigation. Oh, I'm sorry. I got confused. The mitigation strategies are secure storage. Use secure cryptocurrency wallets with strong passwords, MFAs, and hardware wallets for significant holdings. Another mitigation is double check each transaction. by verifying recipient addresses before sending cryptocurrencies and ensure the accuracy to prevent irreversible mistakes. And backup. Regularly backup your wallet keys and password in a secure location. Another risk is regulatory risk. The regulatory status of certain cryptocurrencies remain uncertain, with numerous governments contemplating whether to classify them as securities, currencies, or both. Another risk is the regulatory, the mitigation strategies are: one, stay informed. Keep up to date with cryptocurrency regulations in your country and globally. The second one is compliance. Abide by the local regulations and tax laws related to cryptocurrencies. The third one is diversify. Invest in cryptocurrencies with clear regulatory compliance to reduce exposure to uncertain assets, which means don't put all the eggs in one basket. Another risk is counterparty risks. Numerous investors and businesses entrust exchanges or other custodial entities to safeguard their cryptocurrency holdings. If one of these third parties providers experience theft or loss, it could result in the complete loss of one's investments. Mitigations are: choose a reputable exchange. You can use a well-established cryptocurrency exchange with a track record of security and reliability, probably Bitcoin. Another mitigation strategy is to self-custody. Consider self-custody options like hardware wallets to have full control over your assets. And the last one is insurance. Look for exchanges or custodians that offer insurance coverage for potential losses. Okay, now that we talk a little bit about cryptocurrencies, let's understand a little bit about what blockchain is. I would like to tell you that blockchain came up as a group idea from researchers that wanted to digital documents to be timestamped in a way that such documents could not be backdated or modified with an effort to keep legitimacy. I'm sorry, I might need help here. Legitimacy. Okay, that's fine. Every transaction is recorded within a block, and each of these blocks includes information about transaction, including the date, time, expenditure amount, the product involved, and details about the parties involved in the transaction. All the blocks are managed with the assistance of the block header. A block header typically consists of several components, including block number or index, which is an unique identifier for the block within the blockchain sequence, a previous block hash, the cryptographic hash of the previous block header, which creates a chain of blocks, ensuring the integrity and immutability of the blockchain. Another one is timestamp. The timestamp indicates when the block was created or mined. This one is Merkle root, a hash value that represents all the transactions within the blocks. It is derived from the transaction data in the block. Nonce, a random number used in the mining process to find a valid block hash that meets certain criteria, which can be a proof of work, and we'll go into detail later. Difficulty target, and that's the last one. A value that determines the level of difficulty for miners to find a valid block hash. It is part of the proof of work algorithm. These components play a crucial role in securing and linking blocks in the blockchain. So I placed a diagram to how that works. And you can see a transaction is being requested. The next step, the block that represents the transaction is created. And After each creation of each block, it undergoes a verification process by the nodes within this decentralized peer-to-peer network. During this process, nodes collectively reach a consensus of whether to accept or reject each transaction, forming the foundation of the consensus mechanisms. Mainly, there are two prevalent consensus mechanisms. One of them is POW, or proof of work, and the other one is a proof of stake, or POS. In POW, or proof of work, a participant node must demonstrate that the work they have performed, they got the task to show how what type of work have they done, and need to submit a criteria to gain the privilege of appending new transaction to the blockchain. This is a little bit complicated, so I try to be as basic as possible. POW also requires a high energy consumption and long processing times for the Bitcoin mining. On the other hand, POS, or proof of stake, it is a low energy consuming alternative to the POW algorithms. Here users stake their tokens to be given to the privilege of conducting work on the blockchain for rewards like transactions fees. Once a majority of nodes validate a transaction, it receives a timestamp and it is assigned a unique hash, solidifying as an immutable record in the database. Subsequently, the ledger is updated and the block it is appended to the database, thus extending the chains of interconnected blocks. Notably, blockchain users collectively serve as administrators, eliminating the need for centralized authority. Each block or each entry is associated with a specific user and references their prior entities or prior entries, ensuring a transparent and trustworthy record for each user's activities on the network. The decentralized network and autonomous system allows the blockchain to transparently manage information across its peer-to-peer network and its users. Now we're going to cover up a little, like, some applications of blockchains to the real world. Although blockchain technology has been popularized, mostly cryptocurrencies, it is certainly not the only use case available in the world. Applications of blockchains are also present in other industries like supply chain management, healthcare, and government, for example, voting systems. Blockchain technology finds valuable application in supply chain management by revolutionizing transparency, traceability, and operational efficiency. Through blockchains, the origin and journey of the products can be meticulously tracked, assuring customers of product authenticity and quality. Particularly critical in sectors like food and luxury goods, smart contracts automate and enforce agreements, triggering actions like payments and shipments when determined conditions are met, streamlining the processes. Real inventory management reduces errors, optimize stock levels, and minimize waste. Blockchain technology empowers healthcare organizations to deliver optimal patient care and top-notch health services. It addresses the time-consuming and repetitive nature of the healthcare health information exchange, which has traditionally inflated healthcare costs. With blockchains, this issue can be resolved. Moreover, citizens can participate in health research initiatives while improve research and the sharing of public health data, promising enhanced treatment outcomes for diverse communities. The implementation of this technology also helps to safeguard healthcare data, managing genomics data, electronic data management, and medical records. Another application is in voting systems, which offers secure and immutable records by recording each vote in an unchangeable transaction of the blockchain, assuring the integrity of such votings. As you can see, I think it was in the election of 2020. Trump, you guys know what happened. I don't want to go into politics. Additionally, it enhanced security through identity verification. What voters' identities are secure tied to blockchain-based digital identities, minimizing the risk of fraud. Furthermore, blockchain facilitates secure remote and overseas voting, enables citizens worldwide to participate in a potential boom. And another one is, okay, that's good. Let's go. Keep going. Some benefits of blockchains are immutability. It's not possible to erase or replace record data, which means blockchains inhibits data tampering with the network. An example can be with the land title records. Once a land title is recorded on the blockchain, it cannot be altered or tampered with. This guarantees the integrity of property ownership records and reduces the risk of fraud. Another benefit is transparency. Unlike traditional database, the decentralized property of these networks enables any network member to verify data recorded into the blockchain. A concrete example is in the food industry. The blockchain can track the journey of a product from the farm to the store, permitting customers to verify the origin and authenticity of the products they purchase. Last one, well, the second before last one is censorship. Free from censorship because it doesn't have control for any single party. So no individuals can interrupt the operation of the network, including government. An example is at the DeFi, which is stands for decentralized finance. DeFi leverage blockchains to create financial systems that are resistant to censorships. User can access lending, borrowing, and trading services without relying on traditional financial intermediaries, making it difficult for any single entity to censor or control such activities. Last one is, hope I can say it right, traceability. Blockchains produce a permanent audit trail, allowing easy tracking of changes. Another example is within the diamond industry, where each diamond is assigned a unique identifier, along with its journey data, starting from the miner to the jewelry store. Such data is recorded on the blockchain, and this traceability aids to combat the trade of blood diamonds, which is a term known in Africa for the illegal trade of diamonds and what is being done to get them. So many illegal activities that are going on there. I'm almost done, guys, I promise. Challenges and concerns. One of them is scalability. Achieving scalability typically requires compromising either decentralization, security, or a combination of both. For instance, to establish a scalable and decentralized network, you will need to incentivize a large number of active participants to achieve high security. Another challenge is the energy consumption. POW, or proof of work, consensus the mechanisms requires miners to solve complex mathematical puzzles to validate transactions and add them to the blockchain. This process consumes an enormous amount of computational power and consequently a significant amount of energy. So in other words, you got to have like the latest top computer to make this thing work. And the last one is regulatory issues. Blockchain transactions often pseudonymous, meaning they are not directly tied to a real-world identity. While this can provide a level of privacy, it can also be exploited for criminal activities such as money laundering, tax evasion, and illegal trade, as it makes it harder for authorities to trace the individuals involved. And lastly, We're going to check the future trends and developments of this technology. Blockchain has emerged as a significant disruptor across various sectors, optimizing processes, social transactions, internal communications, and data storage. Global organizations have used these technologies to establish digital currencies while enhancing data transparency and reducing the risk for all. Additionally, it offers customer access to cloud-based solutions for hosting, constructing, and utilizing blockchain applications. The prospect of blockchain technology in the financial sector are highly encouraging. Currently, the expenses associated with money transfers involving various intermediaries are definitely high. However, blockchain technology has the potential to remove the necessity for these intermediaries, which leads to a substantial cost reduction. Cryptocurrencies are gaining wider acceptance and a use of medium exchange, investment, and store of value. This is evidenced through the growing number of businesses, financial institutions, and individuals incorporating cryptocurrency. Oh my God. I'm sorry. Incorporating cryptocurrencies into their financial strategies. Governments and regulatory bodies are actively working on developing and implementing cryptocurrencies regulations. This effort aims to provide legal frameworks that balance innovation and consumer protection while mitigating risk associated with fraud, money laundering, and tax evasion. Now, what does this mean to us as IT professionals? Given the rising interest across various industries, including finance, healthcare, supply chain management, the need of blockchain specialists is expected to go up. Currently, the job market suffers from a scarcity of seasoned blockchain professionals. This translates into an abundance of job openings and reduced level of competitions for those seeking opportunities in the field. So if you ever decide to explore the blockchain ambit, here are some in-demand job roles that you can take a look at. Blockchain quality engineer, developer, solution actor, UX design, project manager, legal consultant, and analyst. And these are my references. And if you have any questions, I'm all ears. And I apologize for getting stuck quite a few times. I just came from a 12-hour shift of work.
No worries at all. You did a great job. Excellent. And I'm glad that you covered this because there was a lot about blockchain I didn't understand. And I think we're going to, because of this, and if we really spread the word, I'm sure we're going to have a lot of people who want to get to know about blockchain since we do have a concentration in it. I think Cyber has a blockchain concentration, or is it? I don't know. I have to look at the concentrations again. But I think we do.
Cool. Yeah, it's this. I didn't know that blockchain existed until like maybe a year ago. I don't even know what the name was.
Yeah, and I was really confused about it. Myself, I'm just thinking, what in the world is all the, and I still have this idea of it feels like it's just all made up and it's not really out there, but it's doing something. Like everybody's just milling around working on something that's not really there. Yeah. And making fake money, you know, and it's just that the fact that it's not tangible to me is the problem that I have with it.
Yeah.
That it's not actually there. So it's something that I have to learn, which this helps. And we had another one last week about cryptocurrency, and this one is really great to help with that information, definitely. And I love hearing you because you sound like my dad when he was trying to – my parents are French, so when they're learning English, it sounds just like that.
Yeah, just like it's not my easy. Accent won't help me with some of the words, so it's kind of hard for me to do it like quickly.
Yeah.
Like a fluent, English speaking person, so
yeah. Well, thank you for your patience. He worked in the restaurant, and he would get an 11 top, and he would say it's an elephant top. So, you know, or it's at the beginning. So at the beginning of time. So there's just some words. You'll get used to it as you start using them. It's great. I love hearing it. Brings me back.
Thank you.
That was excellent, though. Does anybody have any questions for Rociel? Okay. And it's my turn to do. I have it. Wesley did have it in his folder for me to show. So I will pull it up. What we got to do here. Make sure I'm doing everything I need to do. Okay, can you see my screen?
Hello, everyone. Today we're going to talk about smart home technology. Most of you probably know what this is already. Most of you probably have one or more devices in your home. I personally have four or five of them, I think. So, what is smart home technology? Smart home technology consists of utility and convenience devices connected to your home Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, or even a mesh network. The devices communicate with a hub or a mobile phone app, and even sometimes with each other. You can access and control them from your phone when connected to the Wi-Fi, and sometimes some of the devices will let you connect to them from anywhere as long as you have internet access. So what is the purpose of a smart home device? Certain devices, such as the Nest, which is a thermostat, can reduce your energy consumption. It can learn your habits, and it can lower your energy costs and your power bill. Other devices simply save you time by letting you do things from your phone or another device instead of having to manually do them. They can increase your productivity, and they simply offer convenience, again, not having to manually do something. There are doorbell and camera devices that provide extra security. The doorbell allows you to see someone when they deliver a package. They're usually motion activated, and some of them will even take a picture of that. Indoor security cameras are motion detected. So if you have a pet at home or someone staying in your house, the camera will alert you when they move so you can kind of check on them and see what's going on. There are also smart plugs and locks that let you turn off devices or lock doors if you forget when you leave your house, which is a great peace of mind thing. If you are running late to work one day and you don't remember if you locked your door, you can check your app and you can lock it right from there. You can turn off lights that you may have left on to save your energy while you're away. Simple things like that. So we went over kind of the general purpose of a smart home device, but there are also some extra special features. These are the ones that I was the most interested in when I was researching it. Mostly AI. Each device has its purpose, but some devices have these special features, including artificial intelligence and learning. Certain devices monitor patterns and user habits and preferences constantly as you're using them, as they're powered on. They're watching, learning what you do, and they can adapt to that. Some use AI to adapt appliances and lighting to conserve energy during low use periods or during certain times of day. So if you use the oven a certain way at a certain temperature, or you turn your lights off at a certain time at night, the AI will learn from that and it'll adjust your energy consumption around that, and it'll still find a way to save you money and on your power bill doing that. There are other devices that learn users' preferences to adjust temperature and settings without having to do so manually, such as the Nest thermostat that I referred to earlier. I have one in my house, actually. I have it set to 71, I think. And throughout the day, depending on how hot it gets outside, it'll adjust maybe a degree or two to try to save energy, but still keep it as close to that as possible. And then at night, it'll turn it down because I like to sleep with it a little bit colder. So the thermostat itself has a schedule, and it's learned from what I do to lower the temperature at night so I can sleep a little more comfortably instead of me having to worry about that myself. Another device I referred to earlier was a smart hub. There are three different kinds of smart hubs. There's a bridge, there are mobile apps on your phone, and then there are the speakers, such as Amazon Alexa and the Google. Most of us probably know what the speaker is. I have one of those also. And that's what early on we were afraid of them listening to us as we were talking near them. But a bridge is a more complicated one. A bridge is used for all the devices on the network to communicate on this one device. The problem is if you have devices from multiple companies, because it's a competitive market, they don't really want you using another company's device. So it works best and easiest if you have all the same brand so they can communicate with each other. These smart hubs are like the central command for devices. They are the brain. They are how you run the whole home, the whole system. Certain smart hubs, or sorry, bridges, are such as the Z-Wave, require a mesh network to allow the devices to communicate with each other. And the mesh network is a much more expensive, detailed home Wi-Fi system. It's like a group of connected routers and devices around your home so that there's not one. If one goes out, you don't lose network because the whole rest of the routers are still up and running. So let's go into a little more detail on the types of devices. I have spoken about several of these already. One issue is some people think a smart TV is a smart home device. While it is technically not. It is a smart device, but it's not technically a smart home device. It's a device that lets your TV use apps to play video software like streaming, like Peacock or Apple or Prime Video, but it doesn't necessarily enhance your home in any other way. So it's more of a device just for your TV. So actual smart home devices, such as smart speakers, are the most popular device. They are your virtual assistant. You can speak to them. You can have conversations with them. You can ask them questions. You can tell them to perform commands like turn off your lights, start the oven, multiple things like that. And of course, they can play music. You can ask them to play music for you. Smart plugs, probably the easiest way to get into a smart home device. They look like a normal plug. They fit into the wall outlet like a normal plug, but they have the ability to connect to your Wi-Fi or a Bluetooth network to allow whatever device is connected into that outlet to be turned on and off, usually by a phone app. I have a couple of these for a fan in my office because my computer gets pretty hot that I can just turn on whenever I want to. There are smart bulbs. Also have a few of these. They can change color. They can be dimmed, and they have multiple effects like strobe lighting, rainbow lighting. The ones I have, I use to turn on in the morning. Instead of having to get up, I just hit the button on my phone to turn the light on, and I can dim it or turn it off when I'm gone throughout the day to save energy. There are also smart thermostats. The thermostat, like the Nest I said earlier, which I have, uses the AI to learn how you use your energy and control temperatures for different times of day. This is one of the things I will go into statistics on a little bit later. There are security cameras, indoor and outdoor. Most of them are motion activated, and they alert you when they detect motion. There are video doorbells, the most popular being the Ring, of course, that everyone's heard of. I think that's the one that kind of started it all. They're like security cameras. They activate when someone approaches your doorstep. most people use them for delivery, pretty much with Amazon. I think that's the whole thing. Ring doorbell and Amazon package delivery. It's one of the big starters for smart home devices. And I actually heard that read that Amazon is kind of advertising and helping people to get Ring doorbells and supporting smart home technology that way. There are also smart locks. These are door locks that can be controlled from your phone or another device. They are helpful if you forget to lock your door when you leave home. You are driving down the road. You're like, did I lock the door? Did I not lock the door? I don't remember. You don't have to turn around, drive back home and check it yourself, especially to realize that you did lock it and you drove back home for nothing. You can just pull up your phone, open the app and check to see if it's locked. And if it's not, you can hit lock door. Simple as that. So here are some of the statistics that I've been referring to. Some of these are pretty crazy when you think about it. Smart home sales in the United States are predicted to increase by 27% every single year until 2030, at which point they will reach over $500 billion. Over half of $1 trillion. That's insane. More than 57% of all the U.S. households will own a smart home device by 2025. The demographics for smart home devices are actually pretty even when I looked at them, which was surprising. I would think maybe the early generation didn't have as many, or older past baby boomers didn't have any, but they're neck and neck, except for the 25 to 34 year old market have maybe, I think it was 7% higher than the rest of them. And I'm barely in that. I'm at the top end of that. So I'm part of that demographic. 60% of Americans say having a smart home device or smart home technology has had a positive impact, made it give them peace of mind, like the security cameras give them better security for their home, or just made things a little more convenient for them. The problem is 75% of all users do not trust how data from all these devices is used, because we don't know where it's going. We don't know what it's being used for. We don't know if they're listening or whatever they're doing technically. But that 75% says they will still use the smart home device anyways. So I'm going to go over a pros and cons list. This is what anyone should do, honestly, if you're thinking of buying something new or something extra, something you don't necessarily need, or you're just looking to invest in something like this. So for the pros, again, the convenience, ease of use, and control. Having a smart device is way more convenient than having to get up physically, manually, turn something on, adjust it, turn it off. It's way easier that way. And sometimes the device will even give you more control if it's a smart device, rather than just a simple on-off. Maybe it'll have another function like the dimming lights that I talked about. Then some of the devices can lower your energy costs, like the thermostat. Most thermostats I've read can lower costs 10 to 12%. Another statistic I forgot, if everyone had a smart thermostat in their home in the U.S., it would lower the total energy consumption for the country by 9%, which is astounding. Some devices offer you security and peace of mind, like the doorbell and the camera, so you can feel more safe in your own home. The big one, though, increased home value. I did read some of the statistics on increased home values if they had several home devices, especially the fairly younger generations that are buying homes, like 18 to 40, prefer smart home devices, again, for that some of these other features that are in here. Now, the cons, of course, you're required to connect to the internet. If you don't have internet access, if you don't have Wi-Fi in your home, none of these are going to work. If your power goes out, none of these are going to work. So it kind of renders everything useless. If you still have power, but for some reason your internet went out, then you have to go back and manually do everything. The one I said on the previous slide, you're unsure of how and where the data is being used. We're still always afraid of devices listening to us or the data that it's collecting about us in our home. What are they doing with it? Another big one is possible hackers. Smart home devices, every device has an IP address that's connected to the internet. So that's just another way, another point for which a hacker to get into your system and try to access your Wi-Fi. Compatibility, I went over earlier also. Not all devices work well with each other. Different brands don't want you to buy the other brand, so they're not going to be as compatible with the other one. And then, of course, yes, speakers are always listening.
In conclusion, smart home technology is learning, progressing, and expanding. I don't think it'll ever stop. These devices simplify our lives and provide peace of mind and security. But be mindful of data use and speaking to these devices. Also, now is the time to invest in this technology. You saw the statistics on how much it's expected to grow and be worth by 2030. That's kind of insane, so should definitely invest in some of these companies right now. You should start upgrading your home today. If you don't have a device, why not buy one of the cheaper ones like the plug or the light and try it out? You might like it. And then last, of course, is my resource page. I used quite a few of these, researched a lot on all these smart home devices because it's a pretty interesting subject to me. Thank you guys and have a good rest of your night.
That was excellent. That was really a great job. I like that. And there was a lot of cons that I can run through myself when we just had this storm. You know, we had lights go out for 24 hours. And now I'm fighting to get my lights to come on by schedule. You know, so I have to reset everything. Not everything, but at least the lights that I had set already that are supposed to come on at dusk and, you know, off at dawn. And that's a big issue with it, but kind of small. It's just a matter of really having to do it all over again, you know. Well, that was a great job, Wesley, when you're watching this. And who do we have next? Let me go up to the list. Anthony.
Hello, can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay, I'm going to go ahead and share my screen. Just let me know if you can see once I do.
Okay.
Can you see it?
Yes.
Okay. And when I full screen it, when I do play from the beginning, can you still see it?
Yes.
Okay, cool. All right. Well, hi, everyone. My name is Anthony Pisciano, and I'm here today to provide some information regarding starting your own IT business. So maybe some of you are on the fence about starting your own IT business, whether this be cybersecurity, networking, or web development. I put this PowerPoint together in hopes that I could encourage you to go off on your own, but also provide some useful information. So that is hence the title name, Independent Business Challenges and Success. So let's see, there we go. Okay. So an introduction. A small business is a collective that faces known and unknown threats, risks, and challenges, but you're also going to have two secrets to success. And we're going to tie into these continuously throughout the presentation, but is scarcity of the services that you want to provide to a potential client and the conveyed confidence that you have in your abilities to be able to convince a potential client that, hey, I can do what you want me to provide. And before I get into this any further, I want to say that this is not intended to be financial, legal, or any other kind of advice. Consult your legal advisors. I am neither a financial advisor and I'm not a legal advisor. So when we talk about cybersecurity in the cybersecurity realm, we often think about threats like malware, ransomware, and crypto malware. For example, We know about the most recent Sony and the MGM casino ransomware incidents. However, while these are important, we must also consider that there are these operational risks such as equipment failures, network disruptions, critical IT system breakdowns, and things of this nature, right? Things that aren't necessarily caused by quote-unquote hackers. And as IT professionals, it's crucial for us to be both mindful of these traditional and operational aspects of cybersecurity. So I just want to get into a little bit of background. You know, how did I get here? So why did I do this? How did it happen? And when did it take place? This all began when I left brick and mortar university during COVID and I transferred to Purdue Global. Immediately after this happened, I started my own consulting business and I gained my first two internet service provider contracts. And through these contracts, I worked hybrid, actually. So there were times where I was working remotely and on site. And I provided break fix support, troubleshooting, and I also brought proprietary telecom knowledge to the table that I learned while I was in my previous university through Redcom Zone and Calix systems. And I just want to let you know, my business has been profitable so far. I've been able to pay for school and I've been able to fund my certification journey so far. And that's what I want to focus on is you can do this too. This is open to anyone that wants to do it. You just have to keep in mind these two keys to success and these four pillars that we're going to cover. So with all of this in mind, I ran into some growing pains along the way. And one of those was endurance. When you're providing a service, it's different than providing a product. You have to do that continuously. It's not once and done like a product. So I had to learn how to run a business from scratch and provide a service. And 2 years ago, I knew nothing about running a business or anything regarding liability insurance or anything like this. I had to actually form the S Corp, develop the business partnerships, and I also had to advocate for myself. I couldn't go door to door and just solicit, hey, I'm a network engineer. Can you hire me? This doesn't work. We don't like solicitors, and it's the same way in this self-made business industry with IT. And lastly, the final growing pain was learning how to give not just good customer service, but effective customer service. People, people, and people. We work with people. Tech is actually not that difficult when you master it, but and I'm kind of waving my hands above my head right now. It's the challenge is bringing this abstract ball of wax down to something that you can relate to the human experience so that non-technical people, your potential clientele, can understand. And finally, I just want to shoehorn into this conversation that this can be your journey too. Anyone can do this, and all you need are those two keys to success, is scarcity of the services and a really good salesman's attitude where you take into account very thoughtful conversations with people. You want to be careful how you word things. And it's important to note that we are knowledge workers. You need a natural level of confidence when you're dealing with potential clients. Not only must they believe that you're competent, but more importantly, you must be competent and you must be confident in your own abilities as an IT professional. But this does not go without saying, don't forget to provide a good service. Don't shortchange your customers. Don't, know the services that you provide. Don't try to make a quick dollar. Your clients are going to figure this out. That's what you're trying to do, and they're not going to want to work with you anymore. In other words, as a service provider for another service provider, the end goal is making sure that they are satisfied with your services. So this kind of leads into the first pillar here. Let me, I was on the wrong keyboard here. Hello. Okay, there we go. Okay, so the first pillar that I want to talk about, you might be asking yourself, well, Anthony, how do I start a company? Well, if I were to ask myself this and advise myself, what I would say is to start as one person, maybe even a single individual, and try to work up from there. A single network engineer, because network operations is what I do, a single network engineer can service an ISP with up to about 1,000 users, give or take. So anything more than that is going to be probably way too much starting out. You're also going to want to set small goals for yourself. Don't try to overwhelm yourself with a large contract or a diverse number of services. And don't be afraid to cut back if life gets complicated. I've had to do this. I've had to say, I'm sorry, I'm not available to provide this X blank service. And do not jump into something you are unfamiliar with. To provide a good service, you need to know how technology works. Also, consider an hourly rate that factors in your time and your other expenses. Time really is money. Consider if you have a work vehicle. What happens when this vehicle ends up in the shop, right? What are you going to do? You can't work for a week. And on contract, you usually don't get allowances for these types of issues. And they happen all the time. And do you need to acquire products and materials for your clients? It's not likely that they're going to pay for your training, your education. It's not likely that they're going to want to do anything for you. They want you to bring that to the table. So the bottom line here is that your knowledge is worth an immeasurable amount to someone who either doesn't have the time to learn it themselves or they don't understand their technology stack. And this can happen in a variety of circumstances. One circumstance is where they contract someone else to install their network and they don't know how it works. So if you replace a network component, that's money. If you replace an Ethernet cable, guess what? That's also money. If you don't provide anything material and you just you render a service and you spend time tracing a line to identify a network fault, okay, we're starting to get the picture here. Whatever you do for your clients, you need to be compensated for. But this does not go without saying, don't shortcharge or upcharge or bill astronomical rates that are beyond reasonable. Keep integrity, as we've mentioned, at the center of what you do as a technology professional. But don't forget, you have a business checkbook to balance and your own checkbook. And it's very likely that you pay yourself through your company. So there's multiple sets of taxes that are going on there, and there's liability insurance costs. There's all these different things. It's literally endless. And I kind of want to pull all this together into one concept. So in the top corner here, I established a new service for my client after their long distance calling system failed. So this was essentially a system that just came out of the 90s. You had to dial into it, download data, and we don't do that anymore. We do everything over IPv4. So I had to configure a system. I had to engineer it. I had to design it. I had to find a system and set it up from scratch. I had to create a new service that didn't exist previously. And not only did I charge 1.5 times the price of this hardware, but I also charged for the time that I spent installing and learning and reading the manual about this new system. And that's kind of where we start to bridge into this idea of teaching yourself and training yourself. So let's see, is this the, I can't remember if this is the second or third pillar, but it's one of the pillars and it's important. I think it's the third one, anyways, now that we've covered some of the foundational aspects of some of these like questions, how do we start? How do we go from here and do something with it? We need to cover how we're supposed to educate ourselves in a classroom. And at Purdue Global specifically, I'm going to use this example. On ExcelTrack, I have unlimited opportunities to fail successfully. I can just keep pushing that assignment until I get 100. You know, it doesn't matter, right? But when you're on call and you're in the field, things need to be done quickly and correctly the first time. And quote unquote, getting paid by the hour just doesn't cut it. That doesn't work. That doesn't fly. Don't do that. That's violating your integrity as a service provider. So the solution to this is just to practice, practice, and practice again at home until you have this process down before you go to do something and deploy yourself to the client environment. And this kind of goes back to what we were talking about with continuous improvement. It's one of those non-hacker types of concepts that exists within cybersecurity. CISSP covers this wonderfully, but we need to consider our own practices and our own processes, and we need to work on ways to be faster at what we do, but also we have to be as equally as effective as we are fast. Otherwise, it gets done incorrectly. And while practicing, you also want to learn as much as you can about the services that you provide. And if you can figure out a better way to do something, your clients respect your expertise. That's why they hired you in the first place. So I want to turn your attention to the first photo here at the top. I am replacing the motherboard of an HP switch. And instead of replacing the entire unit, all I had to do is replace the motherboard. In the photo below that, I'm learning about, and I'm teaching myself, about minus 48 volts in network telecom racks. This is an important number if you want to work with IT racks and network racks. In the photo below that, we're going to shoehorn back to this image down here at the bottom. But this is where I was learning how to deploy a dark fiber link to the T-Mobile cell tower project before my work window started. And this allowed me, and this is kind of going back to that practicing that we were talking about. We need to be able to practice so that our two-hour work window doesn't pass and we violate our service level agreement. So now that we've covered this, we need to establish what the next step is. The next step, I would say, and this depends on what you do. If you're cybersecurity, if you're web dev, this is more likely going to be like a software license or something like that. But for me, for network operations, this is acquiring hardware. I have to purchase core routers. I have to purchase switches, fiber, NIDs, network interface devices, CPE, customer premise equipment, backup batteries and systems and computers. So I have to have a lot of space for this stuff because they're not ready to purchase these items at the time that I get them. So this is an important concept. You need to sell the items that you buy at a markup. And why we do this is because the items that you buy for the future are going to take up space, likely in your own home, like me. So don't let business products live rent-free in your house. I am literally surrounded by 30 to 40 hobby computers in my bedroom right now, but that doesn't really mean I want to trip over 10 gigabit core routers every morning. So with this idea in mind, we need to also be wary of the used and secondhand telecom equipment. And that's all I need to say about that. You can guess that something went wrong there. Something did go wrong. And I'm not going to touch on it. But what I am going to touch on is here at the top photo, I have at all times, I have about 150 feet of fiber optic cable that I keep on me ahead of fiber optic repairs. And the second photo below that is just a batch of what we call SFPs, or small form factor pluggables. This is a 40 kilometer transceiver of fiber optic, and it shoots an LED from point A to point B and back again. That's, you know, transceiver, right? Receive and transmit. It can do both of those things. I keep this batch on hand so that I can troubleshoot with a known good part so that I can start ruling out layer one and layer two issues and start to get down to the core of it, because you don't always have that visibility in a client network. They don't sometimes let you have that visibility. So this is the final pillar, and everyone is going to hate this pillar, but it's so important to talk about. But as a contractor, you are solely responsible for the services that you render for clients. In other words, there's no room for an oopsie or an uh-oh. Also, do not exceed your, I mean, all of us, I know all of us are very passionate people, and getting out there, we want to go above and beyond. But when you're contracting, don't go above and beyond in ways that goes outside the scope of the legal agreement. The solution to this is just to revise the contract with your client and say, hey, can I do this too? That's the proper way to do it. Otherwise, you're at grounds for getting sued. And you're also just going to want to meet with them regularly to ensure that they are happy with your level of service that you're providing as a service provider. And this is also not a fun topic, but you need to purchase liability insurance, and you're going to want to consider cybersecurity add-ons, and you're going to want to consider million-dollar policies. You know, let's imagine the worst case scenario. Let's say I burned down the building where all of their network equipment is. Well, I'm going to have to figure out how to cough up $1 million. And that goes into the next point that I want to address. It's very critical. This industry is very cutthroat. Yes, sir, and yes, ma'am are your go-to responses. And so, in other words, you don't have the opportunity, usually, when the contract is drafted, you don't have the ability to extend an issue out. Like, there's no way to handle something tomorrow. If you're, and I'm speaking from experience here, if your job is to repair fiber optic cuts in 24 hours and the problem gets reported late in the day, it's likely that you're going to be out in the middle of the field until 4 a.m. splicing fiber. And so I want to turn your attention to the photos here. The bottom photo is the cut itself. And I had to actually take this picture to prove to the homeowner's insurance that they were the ones that cut the fiber. And this was an expensive bill. Don't cut fiber. Call before you dig, please. It saves everyone a hassle. It might make me money, but it makes it knocks like a dozen people off the network. And so essentially what happens here in the top photo is I had to pull back both of these ends because obviously you can't pull them back together. There's not enough slack. You have to add a third middle segment. And this doubles the amount of splices that you have to do. So let's say you have a 12-count fiber. Well, you have to splice 12 counts on one end. You have to splice 12 counts on the other end. So just keep that in mind. And typically also charge per splice. You know, so if you get up into these 144-count fibers and all these higher fibers, it gets really expensive. So the lesson here at the end of the day after looking at these photos is backhoes and digging and fiber optics do not mix. And also, you need to document, take pictures, even if it's a minute like service or work order. Document, please. You're going to save yourself a lot of legal hassle. And after this is all said and done, I want to end on a note, and I want to talk about some of my favorite projects that I got to do. So on the left here, we just have a different angle at that fiber optic splice, and that's one end of the splice. There's two fibers going in. One of them is the old fiber. One of them is the new segment. And what you do is you splice these two together color for color, and it's like Ethernet coloring, but it has more colors. There's like aqua, slate, gray. it's interesting. But yeah, you match from color to color, and then you put it in this enclosure, and you put it underground, and you bury it, essentially, to repair an emergency cut. In the middle photo here, I had to go through and reconfigure the patch panel for my clients because the provisioning on their passive optical network, their GPON, wasn't correct. So I had to reprovision it and relay out the customer layout. And on the right here, this was my absolute most favorite project. But, and this ties back to what I was talking about with practicing with the dark fiber link with the T-Mobile tower. This is the T-Mobile tower. And I had a 2-hour window to go up at 2 a.m. one evening, one cold winter evening, and I had to go and install a part up here. But since I had practiced that beforehand, before I knew I was going to go up here, I knew how to do it and I didn't run into any issues. And if I violated my SLA, that's grounds to get sued. So here are my references, and I just want to conclude on a note here. Anyone can do this. You need your two keys to success. You need a scarcity in your geographic area of the services that you wish to provide, and you need to be confident in what you can do, and you need to be able to convey confidence in your abilities to your potential client so that they'll want to hire you. And now that we've covered these four different pillars that could help get someone oriented and on their feet in doing this, you don't need anything else. And that's really all I have. So if anybody has any questions, I'll be happy to answer.
Well, excellent job. That was great. Just to see that, you know, I mean, for starting a business and you know, getting through it all, starting it up, working, finding clients, all that. Congratulations, because, you know, that's a big job. It's a big thing to start one off and get going like that. And this is great information to give to everybody.
Thank you. I appreciate it. It was a long journey, but I made it.
Yeah. Yeah. I did. I think I did my first one back in the day. I was 26. And it was crazy. Got clients, scared, nervous, the whole thing. Now I'll open one and it's no big deal. You just LLC, you're good to go. You got everything set, you know. You just go on to the next one. You get used to it. It gets so easy.
For sure, for sure.
Yeah. Great job. That was an excellent
Thank you.
Presentation. All right. Let's see if we can. We got two more people. So let's see if we can get these done pretty quick. We're running kind of late here. And I'm really thinking about, because we have so many, maybe we should start 8 o'clock, 8:30, maybe starting next week. I will let you guys know next Tuesday for sure, or beforehand if you're listed for the next masterclass. But let's go ahead with Sam. Are you here? You haven't left
yes.
me.
All yep,
right. Awesome.
Let's share. I just have to make sure I'm sharing the right screen here. Okay. Okay, that's why. Okay. Cancel that share. Okay, it looks like I can only share one screen, so I'm not sure why that is. Oh, there we go. Okay, one more time here. Share.
You choose a screen or a window.
Okay, well, I'm just going to share this. I wanted to share my bigger screen, but that's not going to work. All right, so oops. Well, that's not going to help me. I can't get my PowerPoint on the right screen here.
Right.
Okay.
I see us, if that helps. So that's the screen you're sharing, is the one with all our bubbles.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, well, unfortunately, I'm not seeing how I can run my PowerPoint slide on the right screen. So I'm just going to go through this. So my presentation is, I really didn't do a lot of research on this. Besides my own trial and error, and I wanted to put myself in an uncomfortable position. So I'm off to a good start. My presentation is kind of a mixed bag. I want to show some uses for ChatGPT and, you know, demonstrate some of its limitations. I stumbled across ChatGPT by accident. And because I was grasping at straws looking for a lifeline to help me, because I was having no luck with tutoring when it came to coding. And ever since then, I've been obsessed. Before I started my degree at Purdue Global for data analytics, I knew zero coding. But despite my limited progress in my coding skills along the way, ChatGPT has advanced those skills arguably by 2 to 3 years. Because instead of writing code, I can prompt code, and one thing I've learned is that ChatGPT is only as good as your prompt. So
this presentation isn't about the inner workings of ChatGPT, because I only have 15 minutes, but hopefully you will gain some insight through my demonstrations. And with that, literally ask ChatGPT, and you have to say in one sentence, because he will go on forever, he, she, it. It's a conversational agent based on AI's GPT, architectural design to understand and generate human-like text. In my purposes, it's going to be used as like an advanced Google. I'm not getting full capability from it, but how does it work? By analyzing the text prompt, literally human-like text, and response based on the patterns it's learned on the training set that it was, and it's quite an extensive training set. We couldn't do it on just a personal computer. I needed tutoring, and that's how I got kind of hooked. And it does, if I'm stuck on something on my code, I can have it explain to me what it is. I've already had to copy directions down for an assignment and have it explain to me what they're saying because it was just too convoluted, in my opinion. But I am going to pull this up, and I think we're just going to do this live here. This is the it's for presentation. Okay, so what I've learned about ChatGPT is you don't want to write some prompt that's really elaborate, and you want to fit it all into one query. If you start, this is a novelty, but it kind of gives you an idea of what it can do, even if you don't know how to use Python. So create a program using Python and search.
We can't see the screen you're using.
Oh.
No, we still see ourselves. So when you go to share, if you see the screen, that if you see one of the screens that you have open that you want to share, that's the one you want to click onto. It's a screen or a window.
Okay, there it is. Can you see that?
Yes, now I see it? I see code. Okay. Yeah.
Sorry.
Awesome.
All right, so I think I got it this time. So literally I could just, after that prompt, I could put this in here. I mean, obviously you want to look at it, but you can see that I want to search my Google Drive. One thing I've not been very good at is organizing my competency assessments along the way. They are scattered. I mean, they're on my Google Drive, but they're not in one spot. But luckily, there's one thing that is in every one of my file names, and that's Schwartz. So I think I told it here in the prompt to use Schwartz, which drive to do. And if you copy this in here, and I'm just going to show you this. So I'm not cheating. I'm going to go ahead and delete all this. This is my Schwartz folder. And I will pull this back up when I'm done running this code. I mean, I literally made no changes to this. And if I run it, it's going to run. And it's actually going to take longer than I thought. Oh, what's that? I did put in this in a folder. Oh, okay. Never mind. I didn't tell it to copy it in there. Okay, I'm way ahead of myself. So all I did was start with a basic. You know, it tells me the files that I asked for, all of them that have Schwartz in there. If we keep going, then I'll just kind of coax it along here. So if I, okay, but only include my docs files. And I put that in there. See, this is amazing to me because I'm not that great of coder, but I can follow along and I can see that it's searching for my docs folders in G with my Schwartz name. And these are all doc folders. So just to keep things moving along, change it, the codes instead of Schwartz, I can put a user input in instead of ask for user input. So again, I'm taking this right off of what ChatGPT produced for me. I mean, I didn't write this code at all. I can't take credit for it, but I can use it and it benefits me. So now I want to search for, let's say IN files, IN402. And those are docs. So now I have an input. And it will return only those folders in my G drive. I mean, to me, that's just like magic compared to having no coding ability at all. So if I keep going here, but I only want, you know, give me a user input for how many days ago it was modified. So again, if I copy this code, I'm just inching it along here, coaxing it along. I find if you put too much in there, and I got an example where ChatGPT just goes off the rails. I'll go with docs, and I'll just go with 2 days ago. I may not come back with anything, actually. Okay, so that's, I mean, I can really narrow this down now. If I'm looking for a file that I made in the last 2 days, and it's becoming more useful. So how does this? So instead of just printing these folders and let me know where they're at, copy them to a folder. All right, so I'll do that, and it's just building on everything. So I'll just go through my inputs, and I'll go through Schwartz, and I'll go through OCX, and let's see, it's going to put it in my just in my C drive. That's it. It's just going to be in my C drive. Surprised I didn't name it, but I'm going to keep going here. Let's just go with 11. There's the folder. It's asking me for the folder now. So I'm going to go with Schwartz. I've already created it, but you can see there's nothing in here. And if I hit enter, it is going to copy those folders in there for the past 11 days. And I could just have their duplicates. I can delete them. But I know exactly where they're at. And then here's the other thing now. But these are not so good, because what they have done is created a copy that were all created on 928. Now, if I want to search through, you know, a week ago quickly, I don't have that. But if all I have to do is say, okay, but, and again, I'm just continuing our conversation here. Okay, but preserve the metadata. Actually created this quicker than I could present it. But I want to copy this over. And I just want to delete these folders, files. Oh my God, I just deleted the wrong thing. I think I just killed my power. Okay, that was not good. So I'll go back to here and I'm going to delete all these. And I'm going to run this file now. And I'm just going to go to Schwartz again. Right. And docs. And I want to go back 22 days. And I want to put it in Schwartz folder. And then I come back here. And I have all my metadata saved. Now I can go back a week. I can organize it by date modified. And I don't have to worry about the type. Let's see, what else did I do to this? Is that the end of it? Okay, so, and then what I did was, I created this. Can you see that icon? So just, I made a shortcut on my desktop, and I'll do the same search. And how many days, say, we'll just go 7 days. Actually, I didn't even show you my shortcut here. So I'll go back. This thing is going off the rails. So here's my file. And it pulls it up.
Hello. Sorry to interrupt you. Just all we see is a white screen right now.
Can you see that?
Sorry, all I see is white.
Oh, okay. I don't know what. Am I paused? Can you see that?
Sorry, no.
No, it's still just the white screen.
I don't know why. Maybe I should just unplug my other screen here. Okay, you should be able to see that. Yes.
Now hopefully. We see, no, the bubble screen of us.
Yeah, okay. So here's the file shortcut I made to that Python. I'm not sure what you actually seen, but, you know, you just make a shortcut to it, to your Python folder, or even drag your Python folder in there. Can you see that?
No, just, it's still a white screen.
There, no? Okay. Well, let me see if I can, stop sharing. And I'll share again. This time I'll choose Okay. Can you see that? No.
So, I see. Yeah, I see file search.
Yeah. So what I did was I created this icon. I don't know if you could see that. Can you see this icon I'm dragging around?
No.
No?
No.
Okay. Whatever. So I put a shortcut on my desktop, and it basically does the same thing. And whatever. I guess I don't need to go through this. Oops, but I will. I guess it's not going to show you my results, so that's kind of pointless. Okay. Well, let's see if I could do one more thing here really quickly. Actually, I'm done with my 15 minutes, but I guess that went off the rails pretty good. But it gives you an idea, hopefully, what you can do with ChatGPT. I didn't give you a chance to really show you how limited it is in its capabilities, but I hope somebody got something out of that. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Sam. No, that was good. For the parts that we did see for ChatGPT, it was good. And that's what I heard. You really have to make sure you know what you're putting in the prompt to get out what you want from ChatGPT. That's the biggest thing.
And you don't want to load your program or your coding in there just blindly either. You should be able to understand it and follow along and see what's going on. But for me to sit down and write that, it would have taken me a lot longer, and I would have to look up some things.
Right. No. Well, good job. Great. Kayla, did you have a question? Your hand is up. Okay. So, all right. Last but not least, we have Chris. Are you ready?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes.
All right. Let's see if I can share here. Can you see my screen?
I do.
Okay, here we go. So what is a hacker? That's my presentation. By the way, good evening. I'm Chris Quiroz. We'll start with the slides. So what is a hacker? Hackers breach defenses to gain unauthorized access into computers, phones, tablets, IoT devices, networks, or entire computing systems. Hackers also take advantage of weaknesses in network security to gain access. The weaknesses can be technical or social in nature. With technical weaknesses, hackers can exploit software vulnerabilities or weak security practices to gain unauthorized access or inject malware, for example. Social weaknesses, hackers can also use social engineering to convince those with privileged access to targeted systems to click on malicious links, open infected files, or reveal personal information, thereby gaining access to otherwise hardened infrastructures. And what makes someone a hacker? Much of today's computer hacking has been automated, which is why it currently poses such a threat to internet security. Some hackers are still highly trained technical professionals, but others are much less skilled and are able to launch successful attacks simply by buying attack tools. Now, with hacker demographics, it used to be the case that hackers were often teenagers trying to break into prominent organizations simply to gain notoriety. But today's hacker community is far more diverse and is made up of individuals with many different motives. What are these motives? Well, some of the leading motives for online hacking are financial gain, activism, corporate espionage, state-sponsored attacks against opposing nation-states, or even cyber terrorism. Now, threat actors are more likely to gain notoriety as hackers in mainstream accounts. And here are some famous hackers that did just that. Anonymous is a group of hackers from around the world who meet on online message boards and social networking forums. They mainly focus their efforts on encouraging civil disobedience and unrest via DOS attacks, publishing victims' personal information online, and defacing and defaming websites. Mr. Jonathan James gained notoriety for hacking into multiple websites, including those of the U.S. Department of Defense and NASA, as well as for stealing software code when he was a teenager. In the year 2000, James became the first juvenile at just 16 years old to be incarcerated for computer hacking. Adrian Lammel hacked into the systems of several organizations, including the New York Times, Microsoft, and Yahoo, to exploit their security flaws. Lammel was arrested in 2003, convicted in 2004, sentenced to 6 months of home detention at his parents' home and 2 years probation, also ordered to pay about $65,000 in restitution. Mr. Kevin Mitnick was convicted of a number of criminal computer crimes after evading authorities for 2.5 years. He was once one of the FBI's most wanted for hacking into networks of 40 high-profile corporations. Mitnick was arrested in 1993 and served 5 years in a federal prison. Now we look at specific types of hackers, starting with black hat hacker. Historically, the black hat hacker has been used to describe one of who has malicious intent, such as theft of information, fraud, or disrupting systems. Now, the term black hat has been used to differentiate criminal hackers from white hat and gray hat hackers. These categories were inspired by early Western movies, where the heroes could be identified by the white hats they wore and the villains by their black hats. Now, the white hat hacker, or ethical hacker, is someone who uses hacking skills to identify the security vulnerabilities in hardware, software, or networks. However, unlike black hats, the white hats respect the rule of law as it applies to hacking. Many white hat hackers actually are former black hats. Those white hats also or only seek vulnerabilities or exploits when they are legally permitted to do so. They may do research on open source software as well as on software or systems they own or have been authorized to investigate, including products and services to operate bug bounty programs. These types of programs reward individuals with money for disclosing security flaws. The gray hat hackers, they fall somewhere in between the ethical hackers and threat actors. While their motives may be similar to those of the two groups, gray hats are more likely than ethical hackers to access systems without authorization. At the same time, they are more likely to avoid doing unnecessary damage to the systems they hack. Although they aren't typically motivated by money, gray hat hackers may offer to fix vulnerabilities they have discovered through their own unauthorized activities, rather than using their knowledge to exploit vulnerabilities for illegal profit. Now, an often cited gray hat hacker example took place in August of 2013 when Khalil Shreth, an unemployed computer security researcher, hacked the Facebook page of Mark Zuckerberg. His motivation for doing so was to force action to correct a bug he discovered, which allowed him to post to any user's page without their consent. He had informed Facebook of this bug only to be told by Facebook that the issue was not a bug. Of course, he wasn't satisfied and took matters in his own hands and actually hacked Zuckerberg's personal page to post a message, which definitely got Facebook's attention. After the incident, Facebook corrected this vulnerability, which could have been a powerful weapon in the hands of professional spammers. Unfortunately, Khalil was not compensated by Facebook's white hat program because they say he violated their policies. So now we're looking at a deeper dive into the psychological makeup of a hacker. Now, the dark triad is a set of three personality traits often associated with hackers. They include psychopathy, who are impulsive, emotionally cold, which probably explains why they wear hoodies, and lack of remorse. Machiavellianism pertains to those who are manipulative, self-interested, and domineering. Narcissism, or narcissist, displays grandiosity, a perceived superiority, and have some sense of entitlement. In general, the dark triad traits are viewed as undesirable, of course. However, research from a German study in 2016 suggests that these traits have a dark side and a positive side. It was found that leaders with Machiavellianism and psychopathy traits were detrimental to employee well-being. But in contrast, the same research determined that leaders rated high on the narcissism scale reported better career success, higher salaries, and more promotions. Thrill-seeking was moderately important for white hat and black hat hacking, and opposition to authority was significant for the gray hats. What does this all mean? Well, a natural question is whether or not white hats would drift to becoming gray hat or even black hat hackers. A famous example of this drift to the dark side can be found in a book called American Kingpin by Nick Bilton. It is the story of Ross Ulbricht, who developed the darknet market website called Silk Road. One of the government agents investigating him was subsequently lured to the criminal side because of the monetary attraction. New recent research suggests that monetary incentives can play an essential role in the next generation of employees with the propensity to violate privacy laws. However, hacking knowledge is a two-edged sword that can be used for mischief and counterattacks against individuals, organizations, and society. White hats were found to have Machiavellianism, narcissism, psychopathy, and thrill-seeking traits, but that does not mean they will migrate to become black hats. More importantly, they are needed to counter black hat and gray hat attacks. Well, now that we know what a hacker is, the question is, are you a hacker? And if so, which one are you? Thank you all for your time and happy hacking.
Excellent job. That was great.
Thank you.
There's a lot of information there. I think I know a few people off of that dark triad. But they're not hackers. I think they're just one of those types.
Oh, no.
Maybe now I know what they should do.
Right.
They fit the bill. Any questions for Chris? It was excellent. Just looking in the chat to see if there's any questions. Great job. Great work. Awesome. Yeah. Well, I know we're running late, but we did get through all of them. I thank you, everybody, for staying as long as you did. This is absolutely optional. So, you know, other than them presenting, everybody here are definitely loyal to those working with you in the internship. So thank you for staying and giving them an audience. They did a great job. Congratulations, everybody. And definitely looking forward to next week. I will have this up in the playlist as soon as I can. And thank you, everybody, for presenting and doing such a great job and all your wonderful topics. Have a great rest of the evening.